Hey everyone, I'm Asia.
And I'm Devin, and we are your hosts, and this is the latest episode of On Their Behalf.
You ready for this one, Devin?
I think so.
I don't know. I'm not ready, and I already know it. On the night of August 28th, 1955, we're taking it back, Roy Bryant and his 36-year-old half-brother, John William, a.k.a. J.W., go to the home of Mose.
Hey everyone, I'm Asia.
And I'm Devin, and we are your hosts.
It's about
and this is
two,
the latest
three
episode
in the morning
of
J.W. bangs
behalf
on the door, and Mose Wright opens the door to see two white men standing on his porch with a pistol and a flashlight. J.W. asks him if he has three boys from Chicago staying with him. Mose just doesn't respond. So J.W. pushes his way through into the home where there are eight African-American people sleeping in a small two-bedroom cabin. J.W. tells Mose, J.W. tells Mose to take him to the N who did the talking. One of the women in the home hears the commotion downstairs and begs the two men to leave. She even offers them money, but they refuse. He rushes to the room where 14-year-old Emmett is sleeping in the bed with his cousins. He's ripped out of the bed and is urged to get dressed. Mose Wright, the uncle, told them that Emmett's from up north. He doesn't know any better. Please just leave anything. We'll give you money. We'll do whatever you can. Please just leave him alone. So J.W. asks him, quote, how old are you, preacher? And Mose responds, I'm 64. And he says, if you tell a soul about this, you won't live to see 65. So both men rush Emmett out to the truck. Mose says at this time that he hears the men ask someone in the car if this was the boy. And that person responds, yes. They tie Emmett up and put him into the back of the pickup truck and drive him towards Money, Mississippi. Some sources say that they picked up two additional men, then drove to the barn in Drew, Mississippi, where they pistol whip him, knocking him unconscious. Some reports also say that he was beaten and tortured for hours and then shot in the head. They then drive Emmett to Black Bayou Bridge near Glendora, Mississippi, near the Tallahatchie River, and dump his body. Today, I'm telling the story on behalf of Emmett Till.
Fuck.
This is terrible. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. But I will reassure you that it does tie in at the end, and it's a little...
No, it...
Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Did you guys watch Lovecraft Country?
Yes.
They tap into this, and even like that...
Yeah.
Fucking hell, this is gonna be hard. Okay.
I also have to say... right off the bat that there is so much about this. There's no way I could read or watch the amount of just research about this. It's just it goes on and on. So I did my best to kind of put the story into a certain perspective and also try to tell as much that had come about from the story, or from this case. So, let's start with Emmett. So Emmett was born in 1941. He was stocky and muscular. He weighed about 150 pounds. His mother, Mamie Carthen, and father, Lewis, raised him in Chicago, Illinois. His mother was born in a small delta town in Webb, Mississippi. According to Wikipedia, when she was just 2 years old, her family moved from Argo, Illinois, as a part of the Great Migration, where like black families were headed out of the South to the North to escape the violence and the lack of jobs, and you know, obviously they were treated terribly. Do you hear the?
I hear a little rain? Now.
Okay. Yeah.
It's well, nice.
It sounds nice, but it's hailing. Yeah. That's why it's okay. But I'm gonna just keep going. And Argo, Illinois, is they received so many Southern migrants that it ended up being named Little Mississippi. And Mamie, her mom's home where she stayed was used so much by some of the black families that were coming up from the South, and they used it as like a way station or like.
Just keep going.
I know, but I can't. They used it as a way station or a stopover, and they would just basically stay in her house, and like she would feed them, and she would like basically it was like a transition station so that they could eventually go out and find housing and jobs, so that they didn't mm-hmm. just like go out and then start living on the streets. Like they had a place mm-hmm. to stop, and you know,
that's nice.
Yeah. Mississippi was the poorest state in the United States in 1950, and the Delta counties were the poorest of Mississippi. So just a little comparison to, so the average income of a white household in 1949 was, about $690, which in 2020 would be just over $7,000, $7,357. And for black families, it was about $462, equivalent to $4,926. So obviously they were paid.
Is this a month or a year?
This is, yes, it's a month.
Monthly?
Yeah, monthly.
Oh, cool. I make about $4,000. So.
Yeah.
To make this about me, which it is.
Of course it is.
cool.
Yeah. The average, like the opportunities that black families had were slim to none. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of forced to work as sharecroppers and also either work and live on land owned by white people, which, I mean, it was like that. It was either that or you were homeless and starving. You know what I mean? So it's just like, even though that's not what
it
most...
It created a new kind of slavery.
Exactly. Really. Yeah. So it's just like, as much as I'm sure they wanted to move away from that, it was kind of the only option. Mm-hmm. Blacks also during this time, they couldn't vote. They were like basically... excluded from the political system since 1890. And then the white dominated legislatures passed a new constitution that raised barriers for voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
And whites had also passed the racial segregation and Jim Crow laws. So at this mm-hmm. time it was just, which I mean, it's not any different really from what happens these days.
Yeah.
Which,
I was just gonna say,
I mean,
well, yeah, except now it's all about like prisoners.
Yeah, it's about
felons and everything. That's the mm-hmm. the way that slavery is allowed under the 13th Amendment.
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, not saying it isn't racially motivated, because it definitely is, but it's more about, you know, your, I would say, like class or status, that you're put into a group where they basically are like, okay, this group, like people who are felons, who have a criminal record, or people that don't make a lot of money or are in impoverished areas. Those mm-hmm. are the areas that don't get the right to vote. But, you know, others do.
Except if it's like poor white areas, then they get the right to vote.
Oh, yeah. So either way, it's racially motivated.
I feel like, yeah, racism and classism are so tied.
Yeah.
So deeply together, because the class system is so built on fundamentally systemic racist systems. That was repetitive, but you get what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's like you can't really separate the two, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And that was largely why Mamie decided to move to Chicago and stay there, because it was just a better way of life for her and her family. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the best, but it was definitely better than the treatment that they would have received if they lived in the South. Mm-hmm. So she mainly raised Emmett in with her mom, because, or in her mother's house, or her and her mom kind of shared caring for him, because Lewis, her husband, they had separated in 1942 after she discovered that he was cheating on her. He also abused her all the time. At one point, he choked her until she passed out. And, but she responded by getting up and throwing scalding water at him.
Go, girl.
And I was like, all right, good for you. She files a restraining order against him, but it didn't take him long before he ended up violating that order. He was forced by the judge in 1943 to choose between jail or enlisting in the U.S. Army, which I was like, I'm sorry, but why do you get fucking options? You shouldn't get options if you're an abusive asshole. Like, that's not how that works.
Well, you essentially know? It's like a death sentence.
Yeah.
So you join the army, but it's masquerading as
options. Like, you shouldn't get a choice. Like, if you're an abusive asshole, you either, you go to jail. Like, that's not, who gets to choose their fucking sentence? That's just stupid.
I wonder, in the 50s, so what, Korean War? So they needed people, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it being like, instead of us paying for him to sit in jail, let's put him to quote unquote good use. I don't know. I could see that. But it's also like, that's not, he would, well, I guess, I don't know about 1950 or 1949, how long he would have been in jail for, you know, domestic violence.
What would that 6 months versus 4 years enlisting or something.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting other debate, but just in terms of like avoiding the draft or something, you just send prisoners. It's very Game of Thrones, where instead of you get sent to the wall or whatever.
Yeah. 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 But this is a little, I don't know if this is satisfying or if it's more of sad. I can't put my finger on it, but in 1945, after he came back from the U.S. Army, it was just about...
Oh, so he went to World War II?
Yeah. That's in 1945, right?
Yeah.
What did you say? No, Korean War? Yeah.
Korean War. I thought we were in 1950 for some reason, but...
Okay. Yeah. This was before, because 1950 is when this situation with Emmett happened. That was 10 years before, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
So Emmett was 4 at the time, but his father, Lewis, was executed because he raped and murdered an Italian woman.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I was like, I
was not expecting that.
Right? I was like, well, I'm kind of satisfied because he was executed, because obviously he was a predator and it didn't matter what, you know, sentence he got or how in trouble he would get, he still raped and murdered someone. But then it was just like, well, I don't want her to get raped and murdered, so I'm not satisfied about that.
Point, though, of like, you shouldn't have to choose your sentence, like, that's exactly why, because if he had just gone to jail, that woman, I don't know what else her life would have happened, but she wouldn't have been killed in that way.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Okay.
I know. Unfortunately, Emmett, when he was 6 years old, he contracted polio, which left him with a persistent stutter. And Mamie and Emmett then moved to Detroit, where she met and married Pink Bradley in 1951. And Emmett preferred to live in Chicago, so he went to live back with his grandmother. But... you know, after about a year, Mamie and Pink moved back to Chicago to be closer to him. But it was only a few years after that that they got divorced, and then Pink moved back to Detroit on his own. Mamie began to work as a civilian clerk for the U.S. Air Force because it was a better salary. She said that Emmett was diligent enough to help with the chores around the house. However, he would get distracted very easily, like most kids would. She also said that she said that, quote, he did not know his own limitations at times. She said after she and Pink had separated, he would visit quite often and threaten her and, you know, try to get her back. And then, you know, she just seemed to be stuck in kind of abusive situations. So, Emmett, at 11 years old, takes a butcher knife from the kitchen.
Oh my God.
And basically threatens Pink and says, if you don't leave my mom alone, I'm going to kill you.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So at 11, that's what he was
Brave
dealing
kid.
With. Yeah.
Yeah.
She said other than that, he was a happy boy. He was a jokester. He would play pranks on his cousins. At one time, they took like a road trip and one of his friends fell asleep in the back and they somehow put his underwear from like his luggage on his head. So like when he woke up, he had his like underwear on his head. So he would do like silly little jokes like that. He loved to pick up baseball games. And he also loved to be the center of attention. So he was kind of a character. The summer of 1955, Mamie's uncle, 64-year-old Mose Wright, who I mentioned in the beginning, visited her and Emmett in Chicago. He would, you know, was meeting his nephew for the nephew? No.
Great nephew.
He was meeting him for the first time, and he would tell Emmett, you know, stories about, you know, living in Mississippi, and obviously Emmett never meeting his family from Mississippi before, he was intrigued and kind of wanted to see it for himself. So he begged his mom to let him spend the summer with his uncle. And she had already planned like a trip because she had some time off of work. So she had already planned to bring him to Nebraska to visit other relatives. But he was like persistent and kept begging her. So she gave in and allowed him to go to Mississippi with Mose. So I hope I'm saying his name right. Mose, M-O-S-E. So Mose and Emmett and another cousin, Wheeler Parker, were headed to Mississippi. Another one of their cousins, Curtis Jones, would be joining them at a later time. Mose was a sharecropper and a part-time minister who they called preacher most of the time. He lived in Money, Mississippi, a small town in the Delta that consisted of three stores, a school, a post office, a cotton gin, and a few hundred residents. It was only about 8 hours north of Greenwood, Mississippi. Right before Emmett left for Mississippi, his mother cautioned him that Chicago and Mississippi are two different worlds, and that he should know that how to behave in front of whites in the South. He assured her that he understood and he would be careful, and he left with his uncle and cousins. So Emmett arrived in Money, Mississippi on August 21st, 1955. He met all of his family members. He was having a blast with his cousins. He was also, you know, his uncle was a, or great uncle was a preacher, so he had to attend church. So the whole family would go to church together and listen to his uncle while he would preach. On August 24th, only 3 days in, Emmett and his cousin Curtis Jones decided to skip church and join some of the local boys at Bryant's grocery store and a meat market. They, you know, went there to buy candy. It was kind of the it was one of the only shops that would allow blacks in a sense. Yeah. So they also met a couple of the other local boys who were children of other sharecroppers. And after they were picking cotton all day, they decided to reward themselves to go get candy as well. So they all went together. The market was owned by a white couple, 24-year-old Roy Bryant and his 21-year-old wife, Carolyn. Like I said, the shop mainly served the sharecroppers of Money, Mississippi. Carolyn was alone in the front of the store that day. Her sister-in-law was in the back of the store watching the children. Curtis Jones, Emmett's other cousin, left Emmett and the other boys in the store and went across the street to play checkers. And this is the part where it's like there's probably 20 different stories about what happened now, because there's people that were there, like there's different accounts of like who was there and who actually witnessed it happening. There's other stories that say Emmett was in there alone and the boys had actually left at one point. So there's just a bunch of different stories, but this is mainly this most consistent story that I've read in, in my research. So, okay. So according to what Curtis said at the time, because one of the boys that was in the store with Emmett said that Emmett had a photograph of an integrated class that he from his school that he attended in Chicago, because up there schools were integrated, they were not segregated. So he was kind of bragging to the other boys that the white children in the pictures were his friends, including a white girl in the photo. It's unclear whether this is another, like, it's also weird because this, it's like, even in the most consistent story that there is, there's also discrepancies in like small parts. So this is one of those instances where like it's unclear whether the picture of the white girl is a photo from the class that he was in, or if it was a photo of, like, you know, when you buy a wallet and it comes with like random photos in it of like people, just random people. So,
oh my God,
it's unclear whether if it was a girl from the wallet that he bought or if it was from the actual picture that he had from his classroom. And he basically was just bragging that it was his girlfriend. So then within all of that, one of the boys dared him to then go talk to Carolyn Bryant, since he was like so confident that he, you know, was with white girls or whatever. Another personal account of the incident, it was a book that was released in 2009, Emmett's other cousin, Simeon Wright, who was in the store at the time with him, said that that whole thing was not true, that he did not have a photo of a white girl in his wallet, and that nobody dared him to flirt with Carolyn Bryant. He said, quote, "We didn't dare him to go to the store. The white folk said that. They said that he had pictures of his white girlfriend. There were no pictures. They never talked to me. They never interviewed me," end quote. Ugh. So according to other versions from some of the kids standing outside the store, Emmett may have wolf whistled at Carolyn. I had to ask my boyfriend what a wolf whistle was. I was like, what is that? But yeah, it's that. And I'm like, I can't do it. I can't whistle at all. So it makes me upset that I can't whistle. But so he might have like wolf whistled at her. Emmett's cousin, Simeon Wright, who, like I said, was there, said that Emmett whistled at her. It had nothing to do with the photos. And he said, quote, "I think he wanted to get a laugh out of us or something. He was always joking around. And it was hard to tell when he was serious," end quote.
It's just a kid. Like, everything true or not, is just like, it's just a kid.
Yeah. So, Simeon stated that after he whistled, he, but all of them became like really like alarmed, like, oh my God, did he like really do that? And he said, quote, well, it scared all of us half to death. You know, we were almost in shock. We couldn't get out of there fast enough because we never heard of anything like that before. A black boy whistling at a white woman in Mississippi. No way. End quote. After Emmett and the other boys left the store, Carolyn went outside to retrieve a pistol that was underneath the seat of her car. And apparently some of the boys saw her do that. So then they like rushed across the street to get away. Another source says that Emmett whistled at her again when she was going to the car. However, it's not clear if he was whistling toward her or if he was whistling towards his cousins that were playing the checkers game to like alert them that they needed to we need to get out of here. So, Carolyn, she told obviously her, sister-in-law what happened. And, she told like a couple other people at the time. Emmett and his cousins decided that they weren't going to tell their uncle because they just didn't want to get in trouble. And Emmett, he had only been there for 3 days and he didn't want to get sent back to Chicago because he was having so much fun. At the time, Carolyn's husband, Roy Bryant, was on a long haul trip bringing shrimp to Texas. And he didn't return until 3 days after
bringing
that.
Bringing shrimp to Texas?
Yeah. He was on a
truck driver or something?
I think it was just kind of like, because more of my like reading into who he was, they kind of had like multiple stores. They just picked up odd jobs as they could. So I think he just maybe got a one-off job and was, or maybe he did it on a regular, it's kind of unclear what his job was specifically.
It's so specific,
though. Yeah, like you're bringing shrimp to Texas, which from Mississippi. Well, I guess from Mississippi, yeah, that makes sense. But
yeah,
he was. Crawdads. Yeah, he did not return until August 27th, which is then 3 days after the incident happened. Mm-hmm. So according to a historian, Timothy Tyson, he did an investigation by the civil rights activists. Concluded that Carolyn did not tell her husband what happened because she was afraid that he would beat Emmett up. But Roy was told by somebody at the store a few days after that, and he went to his wife. Obviously, he's pissed that she didn't tell him. Mm-hmm. And then he recruits his brother to help find Emmett. So, according to some witnesses, they were just kind of asking everybody around town, like they would stop like random, you know, black kids in the street. Like, do you know of this guy or do you know, you know, they were just trying to search for him. They ended up picking up one black boy that they didn't say his name, but they ended up picking him up and bringing him back to the store and asking Carolyn if that was the boy. And she said no. So then they released that boy, but it's unclear whether that boy gave them, you know, a tip on who it actually was or where they could find Emmett, but somehow in their, you know, search for him, somebody gave him a tip that he was staying at, the right home. Mm-hmm. So after they took Emmett from, Mose Wright's house, they took him back to the Bryant grocery store. They recruited two black men. These men then drove with Bryant and his brother JW to the barn in Drew, where they pistol whipped him and knocked him unconscious. Willie Reed, he was an 18-year-old boy at the time, saw the truck passing by. And he said that he recalled seeing two white men in the front seat and two black males in the back seat. Mm. So it's not confirmed because even after, you know, the investigation and all that stuff, they could not find the two black men who reportedly were in the car. But it's like everybody's kind of under the understanding that these guys either worked for Bryant at the store, or maybe he had something on them that then forced them to help him do whatever he asked them to do. Like, it was kind of like unclear about why he would,
why they would,
yeah, like why he would, he, they would team up with him, and also why he would ask them to help, you know?
Yeah.
So after they dumped Emmett's body, they drove back to Roy Bryant's home in Money, Missouri. My first stumble. Okay. After they dumped Emmett's body, they drove back to Roy Bryant's home in Money, Mississippi, to burn Emmett's clothes. Meanwhile, Mose is on his front porch, just... I can't even imagine what he's feeling right now.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sitting on his porch. He waited 20 minutes before he did anything, because he just assumed that maybe they beat him up and then they were just sent him right back on his own.
Oh, my God.
So he's waiting on the porch. He doesn't show up. And so then he and Curtis Jones, they head to Money. They basically just go get some gas for the truck and just drive around looking for Emmett, hoping they can find him on the way somewhere. By 8 a.m., they haven't found him, so they go home, hoping that maybe somehow he ended up at home and, you know, they that he was okay. But they returned home, and he wasn't there either. So Mose tells Curtis that he's not going to call the police. He's like, they told me not to say anything, and he was just afraid that JW's threats would just come, like he would, that would actually happen. And he just feared for his life. But Curtis was like, fuck that, I'm calling the police. So he called, the LaFleur County Sheriff and reports Emmett missing. He also calls Emmett's mother in Chicago and informs her of the situation.
Oh my God.
Obviously she's distraught. Mamie rushes down to Mississippi to try to find her son. She meets Mose and his wife Elizabeth in Sumner, where Curtis had contacted the sheriff. After giving their statements, Bryant and JW were brought in for questioning, because Curtis was like, I know who they are. I know their names. Like, he wasn't hiding behind, not that Mose was hiding behind it, but I think he was just so afraid for his life, his family's lives, that it was just like, I just don't feel that, you know, we'll find him is basically what he was kind of, but I don't think that Curtis kind of knew, because he was there. And I think I couldn't find this, but I have a feeling that Curtis knew more about what happened in the store than he was letting on. So I think that's why he was like, no, this is not going to be just a, they're just not going to beat him up. It's going to be worse than that. So I think that's why he was so kind of forward with, like, no, let's just tell the police. Like, either way, we've got to find him, you know?
Yeah.
So Brian and JW were brought in for questioning by the LaFleur County Sheriff, George Smith. They admitted that they had taken Emmett, but they claimed that they took, after they took him from his uncle. Oh, wait. So they said that they took him, but they said that they took him from the front yard, that he was in the front yard at
what
the time.
What difference does it? Oh, just like trespassing?
Yeah. Because then if they entered the home, like, it's different. Like, I assume that's why they said that, because then they ended up, like, obviously Mose and Curtis had a different story. So, like, no, they came in. And why would he be playing in the front yard at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning?
Right.
So, so they didn't admit that they took, that they went inside the home. They would also have to admit that they went in there with guns and threatened the entire family. So,
which seems less of a,
yeah,
I don't know if this is accurate of me, but seems less of a thing in Mississippi.
Yeah. I feel like at this point they're just like, I don't know if they were afraid. Fear, I don't feel like, if you're capable of doing this shit, you're not afraid of anything. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, obviously, you're just...
They are not worried about getting caught.
Exactly. Or yeah. So I really don't know their motivation to even lie here, because why would they care? You know, they seem to not care anyway, so...
Unless it's one of those things where it's like you kind of like, it's technically illegal, but like mm-hmm. if you play along, then you'll be okay.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
it's not far off.
And you have to use that voice.
Yeah. That exact voice, just like that. I know.
Yeah.
Well, you're gonna hate them even more. Mm. So, they also claimed that they released him that same night, that they let him go, and they let him go in front of the Bryant store. So Bryant and JW were arrested for kidnapping. So just for kidnapping, because they obviously mm-hmm. didn't find him. So after the word got out that Emmett was missing, Medgar Evers, Mississippi State Field Secretary for the NAACP, and Amzie Moore, who was the head of the Bolivar County chapter, disguised themselves as cotton pickers into the cotton fields, yeah, to search for, like, and just asking people, because, like, there was a whole statement on why they did this, but just to mm-hmm. get it down to a few words. So basically the reason they did this was because they knew that people knew. Like there's people that knew, but they were so afraid of the white man that they were never going to tell like an official or a law enforcement. This sounds like the
tardy murder furniture.
Yeah.
I mean, tardy furniture murder.
It was also in Mississippi. So.
Oh, fucking Mississippi.
I know. So they were like, well, what we're going to do is just disguise ourselves as sharecroppers, because then the talk on the field is going to be way different than if somebody mm-hmm. comes in and interrogates them.
True.
So that's why they did that. So 3 days after Emmett was abducted, okay, this is hard. So after he was abducted, his swollen and disfigured body was found by two boys that were fishing in the Tallahatchie River. His head was badly maimed. He had been shot above his right ear, and his eye was dislodged from his socket.
Oh, my God.
There was clear evidence that they obviously did not drop him off or release him after they kidnapped him. He had been beaten on the back and the hips, and his body was weighed down by a fan blade. So they tied the fan blade around his neck with barbed wire.
Oh, my God.
He was naked, but wearing a silver ring with the initials LT. And it was engraved with the date May 25th, 1943. That ring, after his body was identified, was brought in for evidence. Mose, who was the first to identify his body, at first I assumed that was because his mother just like couldn't bear it, but
she wasn't around
she wasn't there yet, and that's why, because she does eventually identify his body, and his face was so unrecognizable due to the trauma that he endured, but also because he was submerged underwater for 3 days.
Oh my God.
So Emmett's body wasn't examined before they tried to bury him. So mm-hmm. It's not like no medical examiner examined his body.
Why?
Cover up, maybe?
Just not to.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
And his body, they couldn't, it's not clear whether his body was embalmed or not. And his body was clothed, like they put clothes on him, and then packed it with lime, and then placed him in a pine coffin and prepared his body for burial in Mississippi. But
oh my God,
his mom obviously was like, absolutely not. Like, I want my son to be buried in Chicago where we live. And like, they were literally just going to be like, no, we're burying him right now. Like, no. She had to call.
What the hell?
Yeah, she had to call several local and state officials and beg them to stop the burial and have her son's body returned to Chicago, which they eventually did. So his body was sent to the A.A. Rainer Funeral Home in Chicago. And there is where she insisted on viewing the body to make sure that it was her son. Mm-hmm. This is kind of hard too. Some reports say that the stench from his body could be noticed 2 blocks away, which proves that they didn't embalm him first, which
right
is just, I can't even, like, why? Like, nobody cared when he was being murdered.
Well, they were trying to rush.
And now they're rushing. Yeah.
Not deal with
it. Yeah. Mamie also decided that she wanted to have an open casket. Mm-hmm. And she said the reason why was because, quote, there was just no way I could describe what was in that box. No way. I just wanted the world to see. Mm-hmm. It's reported that tens of thousands of people lined the street outside of the funeral home to view Emmett's body. And then days later, thousands more attended the funeral at Robert's Temple Church of God in Christ. The Mississippi governor, Hugh L. White, was outraged about the death and called for a vigorous prosecution. He sent a telegram to the national offices of the NAACP promising a full investigation, and he told them, quote, Mississippi does not condone such conduct. Which is okay. Like, all right there, buddy. Mm-hmm. Which he's only Three doing words. That because tens of thousands of people are viewing a 14-year-old's body after he was lynched. Like,
and if he didn't do that,
exactly. So residents, local newspaper outlets all publicly stated how hateful and disgusting the murder of this young boy was. Residents and local newspaper outlets publicly stated how hateful and disgusting the murder of this young boy was. LaFleur County Deputy Sheriff John Cothran stated, quote, the white people around here feel pretty mad about the way that poor little boy was treated, and they won't stand for this, end quote. Photographs of his mutilated body were circulated around the country, appearing in both the white and black publications, such as Jet Magazine, the Chicago Defender. The photos were so disturbing that they, like, lost sales because people didn't want to buy them. Just because they didn't want to see his body. And a lot of people just didn't want to look because it, like, to distance themselves from the reports in the news because it was just kind of
right there. I mean, it's the same thing. Yeah, same thing that is happening today with, like, all this sort of trauma porn that's just circulated mm-hmm. and reposted and everything.
Yeah.
You have half the people wanting and needing to see it.
Yeah.
And the other half being, like, give them some dignity, you know?
Yeah.
And then another portion of people that just don't want to deal with it because they don't want to think about it.
Yeah, they don't want to know. Like, I sometimes I feel like I do that. Like, I definitely, like, as much as I love researching and covering cases like this, or even just interested in true crime in general, there's definitely a point where I just shut off. Like, I just can't accept mm-hmm. any more bad stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I could see it being, like emotional. You're also in denial. You don't want to.
Sure.
Yeah. And you also don't want to admit that there's people out there that are capable of this. Like, as much as you know that they are, you're kind of like, you know, you just don't want to. It's like, you just don't want to admit something so horrible, even though it has nothing to do with you, you know?
Right.
So, and looking at these reports and all that stuff.
The world is wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So I understand why people are, you know, can be upset and angry about the situation, but also not want to talk about it or avoid it in every way, you know? Yeah. Emmett was buried on September 6th in Burr Oak Cemetery in Alsip, Illinois. On September 3rd, Clarence Strider, He was the Tallahatchie County Sheriff. He was the one who originally identified Emmett's body and stated that the case against J.W. and Bryant was, quote, pretty good. But then he announces that he didn't think that the body pulled from Tallahatchie River was Emmett's.
What?
So, yeah, yeah. So, listen to this. So
why am I surprised at any of this?
Right, right. So, he speculates that the boy was probably still alive. That's what he says. Oh, he's probably still alive. And he insinuates that the body had been planted by the NAACP, that they had stolen the corpse and placed Emmett's ring on the corpse and then dumped it in the river.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he changes his account.
Yeah, that makes
total sense. Yeah.
I absolutely believe that.
Yeah. He changes his account after comments were published in the press disparaging the people of Mississippi, later saying, quote, "The last thing I wanted to do was defend those Peckerwoods, but I just had no choice about it," end quote.
What is that word you said?
He said Peckerwoods.
What does that mean?
Let's look it up.
Is that?
I don't know. He calls the white guys Peckerwood, so I'm assuming it's a.
Let's Google Peckerwood real quickly. Peckerwood. Why is it a Peckerwood shirt and hat coming up?
I don't know, but I just looked it up.
It's a poor white person.
What
is a Peckerwood shirt?
Why would anybody want a Peckerwood shirt?
I guess it's like. This one says, like, crazy ass Peckerwood. Oh, from Grand Theft Auto?
Oh.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's referring to them as poor white people, so.
Okay.
Bryant and JW were indicted for murder. According to History.com, the state's prosecuting attorney, Hamilton Caldwell, was not confident that he could get a conviction in a case of white violence against black male or a black male who was accused of insulting a white woman.
Wait. That's a charge?
Yes. So, well, he's saying that he didn't think, because they were charged for murder, JW and Bryant.
But because of the circumstances, he didn't think he could get
a conviction because.
Oh, okay. You know. I misunderstood. Okay.
A local black paper.
But even so, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's ridiculous, especially to go into the whole thing with that mentality. Like, okay, well, we're probably not going to get a conviction because it has to do with white and black. Like, no, yeah.
I mean, you do see that. I mean, I agree with you, but you do see that kind of logic a lot of times in other cases too, like how I can't remember which one it was, but somebody was tried for second degree murder instead of first because they didn't think they could get them on first degree murder.
Yeah, yeah.
They knew they could get them on second. I can't remember what case.
Yeah,
that was.
I can't remember either. But yeah,
it's all stupid, and I hate it.
Yeah,
but okay.
Well, the local black paper was surprised at the indictment in general because they were like, wow, this is a first. They praised the decision, as did the New York Times. But the NAACP expressed their concerns to the prosecuting attorney, Gerald Chatham, I think that's how you say his name, that his office would not be able to secure a guilty verdict despite all of the compelling evidence. So even the NAACP was feeling that way. So it was just like, you know, this at this point going into this trial, right, everything was kind of like, well, thanks for the indictment, but we're probably not going to, this isn't going to end well. Mm-hmm. But get this right. Such bullshit.
What?
So, as we know, they were Peckerwoods, so they were not, you know, they were poor white people. So, even despite Bryant and JW believing that they were somehow the superior race and could commit murder, killing a 14-year-old boy and get away with it, they were it just blows my mind that for some reason they believe that they're the superior race, but then they're also not well off. You know what I mean? Like, you're not some rich, you know. So,
well, because they think that they have the possibility of becoming that way. So they don't want that take. You see it with the Biden tax plan, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I make $30,000 a year, but I don't want higher taxes because I could eventually make over $400,000.
Exactly.
It's like, maybe.
Maybe, but
I hope you do.
Yeah.
I hope everybody does. But guess what? Streets aren't going to pave themselves, bitch.
Exactly. But they couldn't afford lawyers. They couldn't afford decent lawyers to defend them. But, you know, because they're white, the...
oh, no, don't.
Yeah. So, five attorneys. Five. From the Sumner Law Firm offered their services pro bono.
Fucking Sumners.
Not only that, but supporters around Money, Mississippi placed collection bars or jars in stores and other public places, which eventually gathered over $10,000.
You know what this sounds like?
For
this
their defense. This
sounds like fucking Derek Chauvin's and Kyle Rittenhouse's fucking GoFundMe.
Yes.
To defend their white ass murdering bitch heads.
Yes.
That's a good one.
It is infuriating. So the trial was held in the county courthouse in Sumner on September in September 1955, west of the Tallahatchie County, because Emmett's body was found in that area. Which I don't understand, because usually, well, now, I don't know what, like, if the laws were different, but, like, usually you don't hold the trial in the place where it happened, because then you don't get a fair trial, because everybody's, like, you select a jury, they're going to be biased, because...
Mm. Well, they're doing everything right and by the book in this case, so I don't know why this would be any
true
different.
But it just seems like, well, duh, of course you're not gonna get, but it's also, you would think that they would try to do that, because this isn't a black person on trial, these are two white men on trial, you know. Like, there's a there's a, if there was a black man on trial, I'm sure that they wouldn't give a shit where they would do it, because they know the outcome. But it would just seem like they would want this to be as fair as possible. Or maybe they don't want it to be as fair as possible.
No, they want it to be unfair to get them off, right? Whatever.
The trial lasted for 5 days. The day before the trial, though, a young black man by the name of Frank Young arrived to the prosecution. And he said... he knew of two witnesses to the crime. He said Levi Too Tight Collins and Henry Lee Loggins were black employees of Leslie J.W., J.W.'s brother, and whose shed Emmett was beaten in. So, and Collins and Loggins were spotted with J.W. and Bryant and Emmett at the time of all this happening. So they were like the perfect witnesses for the prosecution. But the Sheriff Snyder, he booked them into a Charleston, Mississippi jail to keep them from testifying. So the guy that said that his body or Emmett's body wasn't really his and he was probably still alive, he booked these two witnesses into jail so that they couldn't testify in the trial. Yeah.
Holy shit.
The courtroom was filled with to capacity with 280 spectators. Black attendees obviously were put in a different section because of segregation. The press and all major national newspapers were in attendance, including the Black publications, and those reporters were also forced to sit in the Black section of the courtroom. And they were forced to sit furthest away from the jury. So the white press.
So they wouldn't have to look them in the eye.
Yeah, like the white press was right next to the the jury. So Sheriff Snyder, this is so terrible, but he, as the Black spectators came in back from lunch, he addresses them all by saying, "Hello, N-word." In the fucking courtroom. Come on now. Jury members were also allowed to drink beer while they were...
They're just bribing them.
Yep, they were allowed to drink beer while they were on duty.
Holy shit.
And all of the white male spectators had handguns strapped to their belts.
Oh my gosh, this literally feels like today.
Carolyn was allowed to testify, but she was not allowed to testify in front of the jury because the prosecution objected that her testimony was irrelevant to Emmett's abduction and murder, which I absolutely agree with. So during the trial, she testifies that Emmett grabbed her hand while she was stocking candy and said, quote, "How about a date, baby?"
When did that, what?
This is her... That's new. This is what she's saying happened, but based on the people that were in the store with Emmett, because it's unclear who was in the store when, this is what she's saying has happened. So she says that after she freed herself from his grasp, that Emmett followed her to the cash register, grabbed her waist and said, quote, "What's the matter, baby? You can't take it." She said she freed herself again, and Emmett said to her, "You needn't be afraid of me, baby." And then he used one, quote, unprintable word and said, "I've been with white women before. It's okay." She also alleged that one of Emmett's friends then came into the store, grabbed him by the arm, and ordered him to leave. So, which... Okay, whatever. The defense sought to cast doubts on the identity of the body, because that's what Sheriff Snyder, whatever his name is, said from the beginning. So that was kind of their whole thing, is that it's not even Emmett. So I don't even understand. Like, if it's not even really him, then how can you prove that murder took place or whatever? And they also were like, "We don't believe that Emmett's even dead at all. You guys are just making this up," is pretty much their side of things. The defense also said that although Brian and JW had taken Emmett from his great uncle's house, that they released him that night. So wherever he went after that was up to him, and none of that ever happened, pretty much. They also attempted to prove that Mose Wright, who identified Bryant and JW as the men who took Emmett from his home, but they are trying to combat that with, well, JW is the only one that had a flashlight that night, so how could he be able to identify, and there was no other lights on in the house, so how could he identify two men with only one flashlight? It's just, they're grasping at straws at this point.
Oh my god.
And so then Mose was like, well, they identified themselves when they came into my home, so like, even if you're saying that I couldn't see them, they identified themselves when they walked in. So they both said JW and Brian, like that's how they addressed themselves. Yeah. And Wright said the only one that he really did see clearly was JW, but that, so even if he didn't clearly see Bryant, he still clearly saw JW. So what's, like, you know?
Yeah.
So Wright, or Mose, his testimony was considered to be remarkably courageous because it was the first time ever that a black man had testified to the guilt of a white man in open court. And that the black man actually lived, like, survived after that, because it has happened before.
Oh my God.
But they always end up getting killed or lynched or whatever after. So he was the only black man that has ever survived a court case like this. Journalist James Hicks, who was in the courtroom at the time, said, and he worked for the Black News Wire service, and he said he was so impressed by Mose, who stood to identify JW. He pointed at him, saying, "There he is." He called it a historic moment. Another reporter who covered the trial for the New Orleans Times said that it was, quote, "the most dramatic thing I have ever seen in my career."
Wow.
Emmett's mother, she testified as well, saying that before her son left for Mississippi, she instructed him to watch his manners in Mississippi, and that if a situation should come up, that, and he was asked to get on his knees to ask forgiveness of a white person, that he should do it without a thought. And she said that he agreed, and he was well aware of that's what he would need to do if anything were to come up like this.
Mm-hmm. That's such a terrible thing to have to tell your son.
I know. And it's like, she's like, "I know my son. I know my son better than you do. And I know that he would never have disrespected anybody, and then also if he did, he knew what to do in order to, you know, to make it right, you know."
Well, not make it or right, but
to not
upset the balance. Yeah,
exactly. You're right.
Yeah.
The defense also questioned her identification of her son in the casket in Chicago, because his body was so badly maimed that, like, how could she know that that was her son? And also, she had a $400 life insurance policy that she had taken out on him, so they assumed that, like, which is, like, what are you assuming here, that she killed her own son? Or she's faking her son's death to get $400?
It's literally, like, any freaking thing.
Yeah, of course. As the,
sorry, Moko's been, like, coughing and sneezing.
So it's okay.
That might come up.
That's all right. So the trial progressed. LaFleur County Sheriff George Smith, Ann Howard, and several reporters, both black and white, attempted to locate Collins and Loggins, the guys that were put in jail, so they couldn't testify, and they were not able to find them, as well as three other witnesses that saw Collins and Loggins with JW and Bryant at the Leslie property. So they couldn't find them either. But two of them testified that they heard someone being beaten in the barn and like cries for help. One of them testified so quietly because he was so scared that he wasn't going to make it out of this, that the judge had to ask him several times to speak louder so that he could hear, so that the court could hear him. And at that point he said he heard the victim cry out, "Mama, Lord, have mercy, Lord, have mercy." And this fucking piece of shit, Sheriff Strider, he testifies to the for the defense, that his theory that Emmett is still alive and that the body that was retrieved from the river was actually of a white man. Which is like, he's coming up with this too, because you didn't say that in the beginning when you identified the body then. You didn't say that this was a white guy. You said it was Emmett. So now you're changing your story. After the trial, obviously both sides got their concluding statements, and the prosecution, they said that what Emmett did was wrong, but that his actions warranted a spanking, not murder.
Oh my God.
And the defense, their closing statements said that the prosecution's theory of the events on the night of Emmett's murder was improbable, and said that the jury's, quote, forefathers would turn over in their graves if they convicted Brian and J.W. So, and it's like they're also putting the guilt on the jury to, like, not go against them. Yeah. Because it's like, oh, be careful, because, you know, this could be karma could come back on you, you know, forcing them to.
Yeah. And, like, questioning their, like, Americanhood. Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's terrible. God. So, and in Mississippi, there's only three possible outcomes for capital murder. One of them is life in prison, and then the death penalty or acquittal. So on September 23rd, the all-white, all-male jury, both black women and blacks, or both women and blacks were banned from being on the jury. They acquitted both the defendants after 67 minutes of deliberation.
Oh, yes. My God.
One of the jurors said, quote, "If we hadn't stopped to drink a pop, it wouldn't have taken that long," unquote.
He literally said the joke that we always make about them going to fucking brunch.
I know. Literally, that's what they did.
What the fuck?
So,
get out of here. I hope they all
rot in hell.
Yeah. I was going to say, I hope their guilt turns to cancer and their flesh melts, but that's...
Oh, that's kind of fitting. You'll see. Okay, so then there was a lot of, like, literally, I wrote down the number, too. I found, like, 14 articles based on just the reactions from this case. I couldn't read all of them. Like, I literally was going out of my mind trying to read all of them. So these are just some that I picked out that, like, you know, reactions from the case, and also people who believed the reason for the outcome of the trial, other than that they're just all racist. But one of the reasons was that they said that Mamie Emmett Bradley, Emmett's mother, the reason that they were acquitted is because she didn't cry enough on the stand.
Bye.
I was like,
"You can go."
What? So the jury also noted that they picked exclusively from the Hill Country section of the Tallahatchie County, which was more of the poorer people. And it basically, if they would have chosen, like, wealthier white people, that they wouldn't have felt sympathy for the poor white people on trial, you know, the poor white guys. So that they should have chosen jurors from a wealthier area, because then they wouldn't have had felt bad for them. And I'm like, okay, how do you feel bad for two people that murdered a 14-year-old? Like, literally mangled his body. Like, how can you feel bad, rich or poor? Like, how do you feel bad for people like that? The prosecution was also criticized for dismissing any potential juror who knew J.W. and Bryant personally. Because they feared that, because they thought that, like, if people knew them, that they would acquit them because they were friends or whatever. But after the trial, they realized that most people that knew both of them hated their guts. So it would have probably been better for the prosecution to put the people that they actually knew, because then they would have been like, yeah, they're fucking scumbags. Let's convict them. Also, one juror voted twice to convict. Like, they polled everybody, and then he voted to convict.
That's voter fraud. Right?
He voted twice.
But we like that fraud.
Yes. Because he would have basically, then it would have put the jury 2-7 or something. Yeah, 2-7, because there was 9 jurors.
Oh, and not...
They made everybody do it again, and then he got, like, pressure from the rest of the group to then convict, or to put his vote in to acquit them. But he was interviewed afterwards, and he was asked why he changed his vote, and he said he simply just did not believe that life imprisonment or the death penalty were fit punishments for whites who have killed black men. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, so what's a fit punishment?
So what? Yeah.
Murder is murder, regardless of who's white and who's black. Like, what is a good punishment in your mind, you know?
Yeah, like probation? Yeah. Like, okay.
Ugh, anyway.
Okay.
Two other jurors said, actually, as late as 2005... that they believed the defense's case. They said that the prosecution had not proved that Emmett had died, nor that it was his body that was removed from the river.
That is insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
They hadn't proved he died? Yeah,
that he was still out there somewhere.
But
they also were weighing, not that I'm justifying it, but they're also weighing that the prosecution is saying that the mother, she wasn't really upset because her son was still alive and she took out a life insurance policy, which was worth $400. I mean, I don't know what that is now, but I'm sure it's a significant amount.
Friggin' people who love conspiracy theories and are looking for any other answer than the horrible truth that's facing. Yeah,
definitely. In November 1955, a grand jury declined to indict Bryant and J.W. for the kidnapping because that was a separate charge, even though they both admitted to kidnapping them.
So if you admit it, you get off?
Apparently. After the trial, Howard, one of the prosecutors, paid the cost to relocate all of the guys that testified back to Chicago, so that because if they stayed in Mississippi, they were afraid that they were going to get killed or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So they just wanted to protect those witnesses that had testified against J.W. and Bryant. Reed, he later changed his name to Willie Lewis to avoid being found. He continued to live in Chicago until he died in 2013. He avoided the publicity and even kept all of this from his wife, who only learned about it after he died from a relative.
Holy shit.
Later, like after all this happened, there was an interview, that JW, he was interviewed after, for a paper. And he was asked why he killed Emmett. And he said, quote, "What else could I do? He thought he was just as good as any white man." End quote. Fuck you.
Fucking better than you.
Yeah. So obviously the news spread literally everywhere. Everyone knew about this case and basically how it ended. There were just... I mean, protests, people were outraged, not only blacks, but there was northern whites who were also pissed. And basically they just took to the streets and they were protesting. They were basically threatening a second civil war. So Howard had warned them if this case didn't come, you know, if this case didn't come to a better conclusion, or if, quote, slaughtering Negroes was banned and you would actually get a justified conviction for it, that there was going to be a second civil war, which didn't necessarily happen. But, you know, it was close to it.
But guess what? We're 70 years later. It's still not banned.
Yeah, we're still dealing with the same thing. I mean...
And we're dealing with the same
exact look thing. I mean, we just did the story last season of Ahmaud Arbery. That was literally the same thing. During this time, obviously, and all the whites from the north had a very different opinion about, you know, the treatment of blacks, and the South just basically were like, we're never going to adopt that sort of lifestyle in a sense. Mm-hmm. And it was known that the Tallahatchie County had earned the nickname, quote, the free state of Tallahatchie. And the former sheriff says it's because people here do what they damn well please. And,
yeah. Okay.
Well, so now, here you go. Protected now from double jeopardy. Guess who?
Stop.
Does an interview with Look Magazine for $4,000 each. They tell their story and they admit to everything.
Motherfucker.
They basically tell it from beginning to end. Now they can't be charged because double jeopardy, and they also get paid for their story. The interview actually was performed by a journalist named William Bradford Huey. I think that's how you say his last name. But he never asked any of the questions. All of J.W. and Brian's lawyers asked the questions, and they never got the true story from them. They never told them exactly anything that happened during the trial. So this was the first time that they're hearing, like, the truth, pretty much. So, it's just the craziest thing. I can't even imagine what this journalist is like, oh shit, I thought I was gonna get, like, at least some details. I didn't think I was gonna get a fucking confession, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Huey, he said that now that JW was older, he seemed to be more articulate and sure of himself. But Bryant was kind of younger than him and wasn't really as confident. But JW basically took over the whole thing and admitted to shooting Emmett. And neither one of them ever admitted in this interview that they feel like they did anything wrong.
What year was this that they did this interview?
Sorry, I didn't look that up.
Was it soon after?
It just said that an interview had taken place after the trial. So they just said...
Oh, so probably
yeah. Very soon. Oh, shit, sorry. It was in 1956.
Yeah.
So okay. It was a year later.
Like, right
yeah,
after.
Yeah, a year later. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, in the scheme of
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
A year, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. It's so infuriating. So, Huey's reaction to this interview is like, he's shocked, like how brazen they are about it. It's just like, it's almost like the way he describes it is like, basically it's just like recounting like any other day. Like, oh, I just went to work and came home, had dinner. Like it's not like there's no,
because they don't even, they think it's like,
yeah,
the same as like fucking hunting a cat. Yeah. Do you hunt cats?
I don't deer, know. Maybe.
Deer.
Yeah. It's just ridiculous. So, Emmett's murder then increased a lot of fear in local Black communities because, obviously, these guys got away with it, you know, and yeah. According to Dolores Melton Gresham. Her father, who was killed a few months after Emmett, said, quote, at that time, they used to say that it's open season on N-word. Kill him and get away with it, end quote.
Oh, my God.
So, basically, that this whole case, as much as it brought awareness to what was actually happening in the South, it basically just emboldened these white people to then basically open season on Blacks. And
yeah,
I feel like it's mirroring a lot of what Trump has done for the white supremacists. Like, it's just
mm-hmm.
given them the space to be blatantly racist, and nobody said, like, it's just giving them that space to just put that out in the world. And now well, with Biden, it, like, hopefully they go back in their fucking holes. But it's just giving these people this, the air, the, like, the just giving them the life to basically perpetuate this stuff. And it's been going on. This is 65 years later. And this is still happening. Mm-hmm. It's just insanity. After Brian and JW did that interview, though, it didn't really go well with for them. Like, as much as they made money on this interview, it really just didn't go well. Because there's a difference between, like, I mean, there's not a difference. It's still wrong. But they murdered a boy. Like, they murdered a child. Mm-hmm. Like, people don't... Mm-hmm. People aren't looking up to them like, wow, I want to be that one day. So they made it seem like that mm-hmm. because they were so, like, just casual about, oh, we got off and we don't feel guilty and we did this for a reason and blah, blah, blah. So they go back to Mississippi, but basically all their friends, all the people that supported them before, like, no longer will speak to them. They won't. They Good. Took back a lot of the money that they raised for them. They basically cut them off completely. Black, not only did their supporters and their friends do this, but also the blacks in the South boycotted their shops because they had a bunch of stores. They wouldn't mm-hmm. shop there anymore, which were predominant, like I said earlier, their shops were mainly used by the sharecroppers. So that's where they got most of their money, and they just stopped using their stores. And they eventually went bankrupt and had to close all of their stores. Also, banks refused to grant them any loans or plant crops. They struggled to, like, just money-wise to do anything. Like, people wouldn't even rent to them because of this situation. JW, managed to secure 217 acres and a $4,000 loan to plant cotton, but blacks refused to work for him. Amazing. So he had to then pay whites to do it, but he had to pay them a higher wage because they were white, so they made more money, and he eventually couldn't hold the property, so then he lost that too. They both then relocated to Texas, but everybody knew who they were, so they continued to, like, try to get property and try to find jobs and open stores, but, like, no one would give them anything. So, they were both basically, or JW ended up working as a heavy equipment operator, but then he, became ill and he had to retire. And JW, he also had, like, a bunch of assault and battery charges, writing bad checks, and he had, like, a stolen credit card, too.
Overall fucking
shitty. And it's just, like, this is the shit that shocks me. It's just, like, oh, okay, you're the superior race, but you can do all of this stuff, but God forbid there's a working black mother, single mother, and she goes to get welfare, and she's taking advantage of the system. It's just, it's ridiculous. Yep. But like you said before... you hoped that all of that would just spiral or manifest into cancer. He died of spinal cancer on December 30th, 1980, at the age of 61. Bryant.
That's the best day of
ever. Right? Bryant, he worked as a welder in Texas until he started to go blind, which forced him to give up his employment there. And his wife, Carolyn, divorced him as well.
Carolyn is a queen.
Well, sort of. He then remarried and tried to open a store in Ruleville, Mississippi. But then he was convicted in 1984 and in 1988 of food stamp fraud.
Oh, right? My God. This fucking guy.
They're ridiculous.
But really murder.
Yeah. He did an interview in 1985 where he now is denying killing Emmett. And he said, quote, "If Emmett hadn't got out of line, it probably wouldn't have happened to him," end quote.
Yeah. Oh, bitch on a fucking stick. away.
So after that interview, he feared boycotts and retaliation. So he lived a private life, refusing to be photographed or reveal any location of where his stores were. And he said, quote, "This generation is different. I don't want to worry about a bullet on some dark night." Oh, really? Oh, now...
You don't want to worry about somebody dragging you from your bed and beating you and then throwing you in a fucking river with barbed wire around your neck?
Sir? Yeah, and he also shot him in the head. So it's like, okay, you're afraid of bullets now?
That part too.
Ugh. But also manifesting into cancer because he died September 1st, 1994 at the age of 63.
Goodbye.
Yeah. So... Emmett's mom ended up remarrying to Jean Mobley, so her new name was Mamie Emmett Mobley. She continued her career, and she also just continued to educate people about her son's murder. In 1992, Mamie had the opportunity to listen to the interview that Bryant had given, She basically was like, you know, I think she just wanted to educate herself on like the full story so that then she could continue to tell this story to, you know.
True.
So she said, Bryant was actually unaware that she had listened because this is before he died. And he inserted at the end of his interview that Emmett had ruined his life. He expressed no remorse about it. And he said, quote, "Emmett is dead. I don't know why he can't just stay dead." End quote.
Oh, my God.
I know. Oh. In 2004, the Department of Justice announced that they were going to reopen the case to determine whether any other people besides JW and Bryant were involved, because there were so many different reports of like seeing the two black men there or the people from the store that may have helped him. I read like three articles about this, and at the end of the day they just found that there was no evidence that anybody else was involved, like it was only those two guys. However, there is a possibility that the two black men that were involved, but they weren't involved on their own, like they were forced to be there. Emmett's body was exhumed, and the Cook County coroner conducted an autopsy in 2005. They used obviously new DNA analysis and dental comparisons to images of Emmett to confirm that the body was Emmett's, because that was the defense's whole thing, was that it wasn't Emmett.
Now,
55 years later, they decide, or 45 years later, they decide they're going to exhume his body to prove something that everybody already knew, which is ridiculous. Also, they found new evidence because nobody actually did an autopsy on him. Nobody examined the body. They just put him in the casket and buried him. So now their new evidence has come to light that he had cranial damage, a broken left femur, two broken wrists. He had metallic fragments in his skull, which were consistent with the .45 caliber gun that they shot him with. In February 2007, the LaFleur County Grand Jury, composed primarily of black jurors and impaneled by the Joyce Childs, she's a black prosecutor, to basically determine whether there was other people involved based on the evidence from the body, and they came up with nothing. They didn't find any sufficient evidence to charge anybody else, including Carol, because they thought, because of her involvement, that she should also be charged with something. But there's no way to connect her with that based on the new evidence just from the body, because she really wasn't there.
Who's Carol?
Carolyn, the white woman that he allegedly... I don't know, disrespected at the store.
They call her Carol? That's interesting. I've never heard
Did
Carol
I say Carol?
Short for Carolyn.
I meant Carolyn. Yeah.
I thought
I said Carolyn.
Was thinking about Carol Baskin or something. Okay.
I mean, she...
That's probably what yeah. really happened, is I heard Carol. Yeah, and
she's, well, she's a murderer, too, so...
All right,
that's okay. Sorry, neither the FBI or the grand jury found any evidence to link Harry Lee Loggins either, because they're, even though they were there and they knew the, like, they knew the barn and they knew the people, like, how everything that went down, they were just, I think they were trying to, like, somebody that they could charge. You know, that would then be responsible. Anybody. Like, anybody that could have been involved.
Well, I do feel like Carolyn should... There should be some sort of, like, inciting violence or something. I guess if she's just... I don't know.
Okay, just wait one second. So, here's the truth. However... All right, here's the truth. There is a however, but it's whatever. I can't get in. Okay. So according to historian Timothy Tyson, who I mentioned in the beginning, he did an interview, a recorded interview with Carolyn in 2008. So she, during this interview, she testifies that... during the interview, she talks about how when she testified that Emmett grabbed her waist and uttered mm-hmm. obscenities, she tells Tyson in this interview that that part's not true. And she said for the rest of what happened, she's now 72 and she just can't remember. And she says, she's quoted saying, "Nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him." So she says this, but she says it before he's able to get the tape recorder set up. So she sits down and starts saying this stuff, and then he's not able to get the tape in the tape recorder in time to record her saying this. But he obviously... quotes her in his writings. Like, he doesn't have an actual video of her saying this. So so then after this interview comes out, she denies it. She denies saying it because she knows that he didn't actually record her saying that. And then her daughter-in-law, Marcia Bryant, who apparently was present at the time, says that she never told Tyson that. I don't know why he's saying that. She never said that. So she admits people? And that's why when that evidence was brought to light or however was brought to light, they are denying it because now she is there's a possibility that she could face charges for it. So that's why they kind of she recants the whole thing. But, you know, I'm just going to run through a couple other things that were recanted. So, years later, Emmett's cousin Simeon Wright also challenges the account from Carol Bryant, saying that there's no way what she's saying could have happened because he left him in the store and came back then less than a minute later and he paid for his stuff and left. She was like, he saw no inappropriate behavior and heard no conversation between them at all. Within a minute, she's saying that all that stuff happened. And he's like, that's impossible because I came back less than that.
Why lie? Like, what?
I have no idea. I really don't. Like, what's
the point of saying
that? Yeah, anything? Like, just leave it alone. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe it comes down to the whole... like, white girlfriend picture is actually true, and she overheard that, and that offended her somehow. I don't know.
Or they were just, like, laughing too
hard. Yeah, or, like, they annoyed her in some way. But then the fact that she even... what she did say that was recorded was that the rest of what happened in the store she can't remember because she's 72 and she just can't remember anymore. Yeah. So Wright says that they paid for their items and they left the store immediately. So that her account is completely incorrect. Also, Wheeler Park, another cousin of Emmett's who was there, says, quote, "I was hoping that one day she," meaning Bryant, would admit to it. So it matters to me that she did. And it gives me some satisfaction. It's important to people understanding how the word of a white person against a black person is law, and how and a lot of black people lost their lives because of it. It really speaks to mm-hmm. history. It shows what black people went through in those days, end quote. So now, March 2018, Congress and the U.S. Department of Justice states that they are reopening the investigation into Emmett's death due to the information that came from that interview. Even though, though she wasn't recorded, it's still new evidence and the case is now reopened. Mm-hmm. So that was 2 years ago. So I couldn't find anything that has come out of it yet. But, and she, I think she's not dead yet, but like, I don't know what possible.
She's not?
I don't think so. I didn't look. Sorry. Maybe she did die. But I don't know if there's any like real, at this point, that they could charge her with.
Oh yeah, maybe she's not
dead. I don't think so. I think she's like now.
Wished she was.
I think she's in her late 70s now, but
yeah,
like, realistically, like, what charges could they bring to her?
She's 86 now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, and what is they're going to prosecute her and she's going to have to spend the rest of her life in jail, which is, I don't know. Like, what could there possibly be? I don't know. So, obviously this was a huge case and, Emmett was I can never say that word. Posthumously. Is that right?
That sounds
okay. Emmett was posthumously awarded a bunch of stuff. So they have a bunch of placards in Mississippi and in Chicago. One of the first highways ever was remembered as the Emmett Highway, which was erected in 2006, but was defaced by the KKK. And completely covered with black paint because they're assholes. There was a statue in Denver that was put up, and it's of Emmett and Martin Luther King Jr. Emmett Road was on 71st Street in Chicago was renamed Emmett Road in 2005. And there's a demonstration was held in 2000 in Selma, Alabama. On the 35th anniversary of the march over the Edmund Pettus, I think that's how you say it, Pettus Bridge. Mm-hmm. And his mother was there in attendance and wrote a letter in her memoirs.
I think it's
Pettus. It's Pettus. Oh, Pettus.
I don't know. Never mind.
Sorry. So Emmett's mother, she wrote in her memoirs, quote, "I realized that Emmett had achieved the significant impact in death that he had been denied in life. Even so, I had never wanted Emmett to be a martyr. I only wanted him to be a good son. Although I realized all the great things that have been accomplished largely because of the sacrifices made by so many people, I found myself wishing that somehow he could have done it in another way." End quote. It's so sad. There's a bunch of documentaries known, some like Murder of Emmett Emmett, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Emmett. Books and plays and songs have been written about him, like The Death of Emmett Till by Bob Dylan. It's just, you know, it's a conversation that constantly will happen. And he,
yeah,
like his mother said, unfortunately, that was a sacrifice. But, you know, we all wish that it could have been another way. So I'm going to end this. I wanted to do this case not only because it's a significant case, but also because there's a date within this case that is significant in another case that everybody knows about or should know about. On September 23rd, when Bryant and JW were acquitted in this is on the same day, 65 years later, in 2020, a state grand jury indicted Brett Hankinson on 3 counts of wanton endangerment for endangering the neighbors with his shots that killed Breonna Taylor. None of those officers involved in the raid have been charged for the death of Breonna Taylor. No charges at all have been made against any of the other officers, and no one has faced charges for her death. Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old African-American woman, was fatally shot in Louisville, Kentucky, in her apartment on March 13th, 2020. Officers Jonathan Mattingly, Brett Hankinson, and Miles Crossgrove of the Louisville Metro Police Department, in plain clothing, forced their way into her apartment, a part of an investigation for a drug deal operation. The officers blindly fired 32 shots. Breonna Taylor was shot 6 times while she slept. Please stay tuned for Season 3, airing February 3rd, 2021, where our first episode will be told on behalf of Breonna Taylor. This week's episode was written and edited by me, Asia Hamilton, with music by Holly Amber Church and social media by Kelsey Groenberg.
For pictures and sources, please follow us on Instagram at onthearbehalf_pod and on Twitter at onthearbehalf_.
Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
On Their Behalf, thank you for listening. Thank you.